Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Pixel Sift.
Hello and welcome to Pixel Sift. My name is Gianni. Thanks for joining us. Now, if this is your first time listening to the show, welcome. On Pixel Sift, we speak to the creative minds in video games and interactive media to find out their stories. What does it actually take to make those experiences that you love? Now, one of the biggest names in game development is the legendary John Romero. Chances are, if you've played a video game, you'll know or have experienced one that John has worked on. Titles such as Doom, Wolfenstein, Commander Keen, Red Faction, the infamous Daikatana, and much, much more John had a hand in making. Now, I had the opportunity to speak to John Romero as part of the XRWA Festival late last year, and he jumped at the opportunity to answer my questions about what games were like to make back in the 80s and 90s, what he thinks about Microsoft buying up Bethesda, which id Software, a company that he co-founded, is now a part, and what it feels like to influence so many other game developers. We speak a little bit about his new game. It's called Empire of Sin, that he co-created with his wife, Brenda Romero, a legendary game developer in her own right. Let's jump into that conversation now.
John, I just wanted to ask, you've just released the brand new game, Empire of Sin. It came out this week. It's a strategy game for people who haven't come across it, set in sort of Prohibition era US. You control a mob boss. And can you tell me a little bit about how some of those lessons and those core principles you've talked about apply to the development of this new game that's just come out?
Well, coding transparently really is important. So when we were making the game, we made sure that our engineers had a lot of communication with each other. So they would do code planning together. They would sit next to each other and kind of plan the way the next feature was going to work. They would talk over the way the game used memory, if it was fast enough. You know, speed is always a concern. And we have code reviews every time we check in code. So we make sure that before anyone checks code into the Perforce repo, that there's a review by another programmer of the code line by line, to ensure that there aren't any, you know, mistakes and, you know, some obvious mistakes in what's been typed, or any, you know, interactions with other parts of the game that person may know about. So it just helps the game check in with better, better results on just people seeing problems.
One of the things I really noticed, as you mentioned there, 28 games, 5.5 years. It sounds like there would have been a lot of really long hours in order to make those games, built by people who really, really loved it. Does that still apply to the way that you make games? Do you think that's the way that games should be made these days?
We don't do that anymore. That was back then. No, nowadays, you know, it's basically, you know, if possible, 9 to 5. And, you know, people have lots of time off. You know, people can't do good work if they're working too long and too late. So even when, if people, you know, people are self-driven to work later, we don't ever make people work late. And if they are working late, they know that if they start getting tired, they need to stop, because it could actually hurt the code base if they continue. So it's important to, you know, it's important for them to get their thing done, but it's also more important not to actually ruin the time that you just spent, the extra time that you spent by introducing bugs and stuff. So, we don't do that. But back then, that's what we did, because that's the only thing that we wanted to do. You know, most of the people it did had no families, no girlfriends or anything like that. So everybody was just, you know, working all the time. You know, it was from 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. So, and that was, you know, every day. I think sometimes we might have taken a day or two off on the weekends, but it depends on how close to the end of a game we were.
We still hear stories about some of these larger projects working to really punishing schedules as they crunch towards the end of their development process. Is this something you think that is just a matter of time that the industry is slowly moving away from it, or is that still the way that games are still being made in the whole?
I don't see how it could change, really. Some companies do that, you know, and a lot of the reason is because there's a date that your game has been scheduled to be released. And there are a lot of engines running, sales engines, marketing engines, lots of third parties involved. And changing that date is expensive. And sometimes it's bad, especially when you're in the holiday season where everybody sells everything. So if you're marketing driven, you know, if you're part of a whole ecosystem where that's really important to release in a quarter or during the holiday season or whatever, because a lot of companies that release a lot of games have lineups and they need to make sure they're consistent. Not everything is falling within a quarter. So because of that, then they will start driving people to like getting stuff done, you know, get more stuff done, and they can't really bring new people on at that stage because those new people wouldn't know anything and it would take away time from the people who do know everything, and that can't happen either. So the only thing that can happen is people either working smarter or more time. But that's not, you know, definitely not a good way of doing things.
Is that a production challenge, do you think? Is that something that could be solved with better planning?
Definitely. Yeah, it definitely is. Definitely it's a production challenge. You know, it's like if a producer, usually it's just like cutting scope, you know, like you see that that you're trying to get X amount of stuff done for launch, but it might be a little too much stuff for the team to get done by that date. So you might decide that you're going to push it off for a future update. But that's, you know, and sometimes those things are important to the base game to get people excited, and you can't push them. So there's a lot of evaluation that goes into deciding what's in and what's out for launch. And if the in the team is part of that, you know, sometimes the team is part of that decision as well. But yeah, there's a lot of analysis and a lot of planning. And you can't ever predict that someone's family is going to get sick and people can't be in at work and just things happen in life, you know, the pandemic affects things. So yeah, there's just a lot of things that companies have to deal with when they're on a launch trajectory, and sometimes you can't stop it. And so you just do the best you can. Nowadays, because the games are live, there's the opportunity to quickly update after launch. And some platforms make you do that, like they make you patch it before you run it. So, and some you know, platforms will just auto patch. So that's great. You know, that's one of those things that kind of helps people not crunch so much. If you know that you can put a patch out later, you know, right after release.
I'm curious, you know, going through and looking at some of the process that you've done, you've got a career that lots of people have been following. They would have played a lot of the games that you've done. How valuable is it for you to go back and look at the things that you've done previously for the work that you're currently to do today? Or is it just move on and keep going?
It depends on your, I guess, your memory. I have hyperthymesia, so I remember everything. I don't have to figure out, well, what was it like when I was making X game? I already know it's sitting there. So that's really helpful. And failure is like one of the best teachers. So it's really important to pay attention to the things that went wrong. Things that went right are usually obvious. So the things that go wrong are the things to just make sure you're not replicating. So, you know, moving forward, when you make stuff, you're always thinking about doing it better this time, doing something better on the next try. And sometimes you you know, sometimes you take whatever you learned and try to apply it to a completely different situation when you're doing new things. Usually, you know, I'm always excited about making new things, doing new stuff. And really, other games and development experience is the best guiding, you know, guiding light to trying to do things the right way to make sure that this new thing actually comes out right.
You talk about kind of working on new projects, and you can see the sort of development of your career and the type of games you made. But I mean, last year you released Sigil, which was a megawad, you know, that was very part of that history, part of that story that you had there. Why did you want to make a Sigil and sort of draw back on some of those earliest days of your game development?
Well, it was Doom's 25th anniversary in 2018. So on the Doom's birthday, I announced that I was making this Sigil and that it was going to be released before too long, and that we were going to take pre-orders for 2 weeks for like boxed editions. And when I was done with it, then I would just upload Sigil to the internet for free for people to play. And so if people wanted the box set, it was going to have some stuff that obviously you can't get by downloading off the internet, like my head on a, you know, pewter statue. You're not downloading that. So it was a fun project. It was a way to celebrate Doom's 25th anniversary. And so I made an episode that worked with the original Doom, not Doom 2. And that was, to kind of show that, you know, you could still make entire episodes in the limited palette of Doom 1's design, and still do some new things. So I did some new stuff in there, which was important for me to try and do something new with the original Doom that I hadn't done before. And that was basically making those shootable triggers when you're shooting at the Baphomet's eye, and then the shootable triggers would reveal the path forward or would reveal a secret. So whenever people saw those, they were always shooting at them because they learned in the almost a tutorial fashion at the beginning that was important to do. So people were looking for those. The hint of the side of a Baphomet's eye somewhere was always important. And it made it really fun to explore levels because you're always looking for that stuff. And I did a lot of really interesting stuff with the deathmatch levels as well. So that's why I put it out. You know, there were a lot of fans out there. The nice thing was that I could put it out there for free. I offer a download version that costs €6.66. That one includes a soundtrack by Buckethead, which is one of my favorite musicians. And that plays through the levels while you're playing the game if you decide to launch it with the Buckethead WAD file. And it sounds, you know, amazing when you're playing Doom with non-MIDI music. It's pretty cool. And those levels were made to those songs.
Mm. The Doom modding community is still really active. You know, there's people all around the world. Are there any stories that you can share of people that you've spoken to who kind of, you know, started their career or even just found an amazing pastime just through modding or working on any of your games?
Geez, a lot of people, you know, I when I go to conferences and speak, a lot of people come up and tell me. I get emails all the time telling me Doom was the first game they played. You know, they now are doing stuff in either IT or game programming or something. You know, I even speak at events that are not game related at all. They're developer events, you know, where people are programming PHP or, you know, CSS/HTML or, you know, MongoDB, all these backend services. And these people started because they played Doom. So that's also, you know, I can just talk at programming conferences or developer conferences. You know, as an example, Gearbox Software does Borderlands. Randy Pitchford started out as a Doom 2 mapper. And then he went to work at Apogee/3D Realms on Duke Nukem 3D. And then he started Gearbox. And he's been going strong for, you know, a long time, 20 plus years. But there's a lot of people like that. Splash Damage, you name it, like any of the companies that worked on id stuff, Gray Matter and Machine Games, you know, Saber, those people were all big fans of the franchises, and there's a lot of them.
How does that feel? So, that such an impact on, I guess, so many careers and so many livelihoods.
I love it. You know, there's a book called Masters of Doom that kind of tells the story of how we grew up and made, you know, id Software and made our games. And the big takeaway from the book that a lot of people get is that it's just this really fun, positive roller coaster that gets people pumped up, and they want to stay up and drink pizza or drink Pepsi and eat pizza and just make games because that's what you read about in the book. And that's what got us to making the stuff that we made. And a lot of people read it to bring them up out of some, you know, development funk or just a down time for them. The thing I think that people really like about it is that they really identify themselves in our characters. Like, I'm just like these guys. Like, I love making games just like them. Like, they feel like they could do the exact same thing, which is great. So it gives a lot of people a lot of hope and encouragement to just keep on doing it. Just keep going. You will reach there. You know, you'll reach that point. So I have, a website where we actually have like posters and stuff of some of those images that you saw and just related Doom and Quake stuff, you know, for people that you can't get get anywhere else, especially if it's signed. But people like to kind of point back to those games in those days and go like, that was really cool. I want to do that.
Is it easier or is it harder making games in 2020 than it was when you first started?
You know, it's just different. You know, I can't say it's harder. I mean, we have engines now. We don't even have to write those engines. You know, back in the day, you had to program in 6502 or 8086 assembly language to make things go fast. And that was a lot of work. I'd say, you know, just having bigger teams is a different kind of complexity. Having more people involved and having to have layers of leads and, you know, producers and that kind of stuff is a different kind of problem than just having four people or six people developing. I wouldn't say it's harder. I'd just say it's different. You know, like, just think back in the day when you would make a game, but there's no way for anyone to see it. Like, there was no internet back in the 80s. You would make a game, and who's gonna see that game? You know, if you had a modem, you could upload it maybe somewhere. But you know, I never had a modem back then, so it's very different than today. Like, I could get on the internet and put anything I want up anywhere. And, you know, the problem is that everyone can do that now. Everyone, it's discovery now. It's a discovery problem. Yeah. Mm. But yeah, it's just different. It's not harder. It's not really too much easier. I mean, there's so much information now. Back in the 80s, it was very hard to find books that could teach you the stuff that you needed to know. And now, if you want to learn anything at all, you don't need to buy a book. You just get on the internet and you can find tutorials for every single thing you need to learn. So learning is amazing. The thing that's funny is like the amount of work that we got done back in those days. It was so much work because we had no cell phones, no internet, no interruptions. We didn't have notifications. We didn't have social media. We had nothing to take our time away from just making games. And nowadays, you know, you're flooded with information, and it just takes your attention away from the one thing. So it takes longer because of that. But it's all filtering and control over your information.
What is the biggest misconception about either your career or you personally that you've heard over the years that you'd really like to challenge?
Geez, probably that I was responsible for putting out the Daikatana ad. I didn't do that. You represent my game, and I told the marketing guy, well, if you want to do that, I guess, you know, if you think it's a good idea. And it wasn't. What else could there be? You know, Masters of Doom has a lot of information in it, and it's all pretty truthful stuff. You know, it's not made up. There was 5 years worth of research and writing put into that book, so it's a good place to get information. I think that, you know, if people thought that I was like an arrogant person, you know, it's not, I don't think it was like arrogance. It was just, I have a pretty, like my sense of humor is kind of snarky and I'm pretty confident. But I was never into putting people down or anything like that. So I think some people got the perception that I was arrogant or something. But no, I was always been, focused on just making games, you know, that was the most important thing.
And just finally, the studio you founded, id Software, was part of ZeniMax Media. That's been that for quite a while, which has just been acquired by Microsoft. Can you tell me, how does that feel, that this some of your work is now part of this gigantic studio structure?
I think it's pretty great. You know, this is a, you know, company that has the resources to really take all these franchises, you know, in new directions if needed. I think it's a better home for all those franchises, and you know, it's in a game company, you know, like the Microsoft, the Xbox Studios. So I think it was a better move. I thought it was great. So it was, I was surprised that ZeniMax did such a good job, but I think that was kind of up to Bethesda. I think that was Bethesda's doing. It turned out well because of Bethesda. And that this move just makes, like, there's no reason, there's no excuses for them not to continue to make really cool stuff. Nothing's holding them back.
And I think that's a fantastic place to leave it there. John Romero, I'd like to thank you so much for your time, sharing your expertise, some of the stories, and talking to us a little bit about your history and your work. We appreciate you taking the time to talk to us here in Western Australia.
All right. Well, thanks for having me there. It's been fun.
That's John Romero speaking at the XRWA Festival about developing games, about the history, answering some of your questions you may have had, and some memories of the time. Now, Pixel Sift is produced by Fiona Bartholomaeus, Sarah Ireland, Daniel Ang, and Adam Christou. Mitchell Lowe is our senior producer, and my name is Gianni DiGiovanni, and I'm the executive producer. As always, we'll be putting links to everything we talked about in the show notes of this. You can find those links in your podcast player or on pixelsift.com.au. On the website, you'll also find articles, you'll find interviews, you'll find videos, and much, much more. So that address again is pixelsift.com.au. And while you're there, why not join us on Discord? We've got a really great supportive community of people who make stuff, who enjoy games, who share a really interesting passion in appreciating interactive media, interactive games, all of that sort of stuff. Just a cool, chill place. If you want to be part of that, you can come join us on Discord. The address is pixelsift.com.au/Discord. So pixelsift.com.au/Discord. If you like the show, share it with your friends. They can subscribe or follow the podcast for free. It doesn't cost anything, and you can get every episode that we make for nothing. Just get them involved. If you think someone will like it, we appreciate you sharing the word. That's all for now. Until next time, have fun.
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator Hironobu Sakaguchi made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1-month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.